I think of all of the gospel lessons that are commonly known among Americans today, and certainly in people in the church abroad, this one gospel puzzles us the most because it hits us right where it hurts in the pocketbook. Jesus being tempted by his enemies again and again at the end of his earthly ministry, and now the Pharisees and the Herodians come around him and they flatter him. "Teacher, we know that you are a just man and you don't prefer anyone over the next," right? The tongue of flattery. They're buttering him up just in time to then trap him with an unanswerable question. This particular passage puzzles us, and it is difficult because, as a matter of fact, let's be honest, it was meant to trick Jesus. It wasn't a fair question. It was meant to trick him, to put him in a position where he could not answer and fall on one side or the other, destroying himself. That's what they are inviting him to do today in our gospel lesson. They're inviting Jesus to destroy himself. And so we, these many centuries later, we too continue to puzzle over this difficult passage. Is it right then, teacher, that you should pay, or that we should pay, taxes to the emperor, to Caesar? It's difficult because it was meant to trick him. He was to destroy himself without any effort on their part. And so, as we read it these thousands of years later, we acknowledge that none of us would have passed the test. And so we simply place this passage in the unanswerable or unuseful bits in the Bible. Perhaps this is just meant for us to marvel at Jesus' wisdom, that he is the divine man. And so we're just simply to nod our heads and say, "Ah, yes, there he is, wisdom incarnate." And then, of course, to follow on from the difficulty, we misapply this passage because we don't understand the context of the controversy. And so we, in our 21st century Western minds, simply take this passage and file it in our minds under the heading, "Bible Reasons to Pay Your Taxes by April the 15th. That's where this passage goes in our brains. Reasons to pay your taxes on time and not defy the magistrate. But I want to offer to you today that we can do better than that. And as a matter of fact, that this passage is entirely applicable to our lives in the most practical ways. We have come together to the end of the church year, and it is time for us to take, as Bishop Parsons at seminary reminded us all seminarians, to take a rigorous self-assessment. The end of the church year has come, and now we are about to enter in the brand new church year with the joy of Christmas just right around the corner. Walmart tells me so. I was there yesterday, and they're already playing Christmas carols. We are invited by the church to consider how it is that we have heard the gospel, that we have heard God's law repeated to us week by week, and we have been encouraged to keep God's law, to bring forth the fruit of good works because of our faith in Jesus, and to take a rigorous self-assessment. How is the kingdom bearing fruit in our lives? In the same way, Jesus himself had come to the end of his earthly ministry. That's the moment at which this event occurs in Matthew, the 22nd chapter. Jesus has now come to the end of his earthly ministry. His enemies surround him like dogs, and they are intent on his death. They would test him, they would try him, he would defeat them, and they would resort to murder. And the Pharisees and the Herodians are the villains in our passage today. This is a strange passage for so many different reasons, not the least being the fact that a common enemy, as they say, makes strange bedfellows. The Pharisees hated the Herodians, and the Herodians hated the Pharisees. There was nothing that they could agree on except for the fact that they both wanted to kill Jesus. And so they gather like slavering dogs, ready for the kill, and they both agree that he must go. The Pharisees, you see, were the long-standing conservatives of the Jewish religion. In fact, as Father Heaton, and I totally agree, has said in numerous homilies in the past, it's hard not to be sympathetic to the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the great teachers of God's law. The Pharisees were the rabbis that brought the children of Israel back from long years of exile in penalty for their paganism, their idolatry. They were teachers of God's truth. The Pharisees now see in Jesus a Messiah that they should not want to have. They see in Jesus somehow an enemy of God's law. The Herodians were not so. The Herodians had basically sold out to the Greek overlords for the centuries leading up to Jesus' day. The Herodians wanted to wipe out all kinds of cultural idiosyncrasies of the Jews, the special haircuts, the special devotion to God's law. They wanted to build things like public baths and public theaters, amphitheaters. We have a lovely one here. Perhaps we've sold out. I don't think so. But nonetheless, the Herodians certainly had sold out. They wanted to bring all of the great pagan dramas and theater, literature folks. But nonetheless, they wanted to import all of Greek pagan culture with a hippodrome for chariot races. These were the Herodians. They were in it for the money, and they were in it for the power. And they really weren't much interested in being Jews at all. So you see them that agreed to attack and kill Jesus were on one hand the religious conservatives, and on the other hand the religious pragmatists. But each one of them agreed that Jesus's kingdom movement had to end. It had to stop. Why? As Caiaphas said in the Gospel of John, one man must die before the nation dies at the hands of the Romans. Jesus' revolutionary movement, his Messiah movement, was causing too much volatility to the institution. Whichever institution you chose, Jesus' movement was a threat, and Jesus must die. So what the first thing that we should notice here in our passage today is that both the Gospels and the lectionary bring us to the end of our church year calendar, inviting us to consider how it is that God has come into the midst of his temple. We gather each Sunday to offer the sacrifice of the Holy Communion. We celebrate the victory of Christ over death upon the cross. We come into his temple and rejoice and praise his name. And in this Gospel lesson, we see Jesus himself, the very incarnate God, standing in the midst of his temple. And he is taking a rigorous self-assessment of his people. Even so, Malachi the prophet, in the very last book of the Old Testament, warned of this great day. Behold, I send my messenger to prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming? And who can stand when he appears? Jesus had come to lay hold, to lay claim to Israel, his kingdom, but not just to Israel, but to the world that he had made. And he comes at Passover. The Gospels all agree that Jesus had come at that moment into his capital city on the feast day that celebrated God's power to defeat the superpower of Egypt, the great pagan power that stood over against the true God, and the true God, Yahweh, defeated Pharaoh. Now Jesus stands at Passover facing his enemies, and he lays claim to his kingdom. Who has authority is the question that is posed to us here in this gospel lesson. Who is the king? The Pharisees and Herodians are sure that Jesus is not. But Jesus claims to be the long-expected Messiah, the King of Israel, the King of the world. So the question that stands at the very heart of this controversy, in this very difficult passage, is the one of authority. See how they pose it to him. Shall we pay taxes to our foreign overlord or not? Caesar, is the foreign pagan overlord. Should we pay him taxes or no? The meaning, of course, is simply this. Jesus, you're acting like a revolutionary. You're acting like you'd like to kick over the taco stand, which is our common experience here. So what are you proposing exactly? Are you proposing that you are king? Are you really the king of Israel? Is what his tempters ask. If he says, yes, I am the king of Israel, then the Romans will kill him. They'll string him up before he can get out of town. If he says no to the question, then the Jewish crowds who had placed their hope on him for so long would reject him and leave him alone. But Jesus' answer strikes right at the heart of the question. Jesus' response is to ask them to provide for him the coin that the Romans themselves had minted for the tax. Jesus responds not about taxation, but Jesus responds to his enemies by saying, "Who is God here? Who is God? Show me the money," is what Jesus asks his enemies. "Show me the coin for the temple tax." The coin had Caesar's head on it, and it also had Caesar's claim. On the one side, it had the head of Tiberius, and on the obverse, it had Caesar's claim. Tiberius, it was written, majestic son of the divine god, Augustus Caesar. That's what it said. That was the tax coin that the enemies of Jesus were carrying around in their pocket. An idolatrous symbol with an idolatrous claim on it. And Jesus says, "Let me see it. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." You see, Jesus has already caught them out, although perhaps they don't know it quite yet. They've already committed errors or had broken the first and the second commandment. First of all, that they should not have any god before the Lord God, Yahweh. And the second is that they should not have any idolatrous images. And they have both in their pockets. They've already given away the taco stand. Jesus says, "Show me where your heart is. Show me where your treasure is, and I will show you where your heart is." And then, as if simply in disgust, he looks at them and says, "Give it back. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's." The idolatry, the paganism. Jesus isn't beating them on a technicality here. This isn't a logical trick. Jesus is pointing to the fact that the Jews had already compromised with paganism. They were no longer worshiping the God of the covenant, Yahweh. They had already given away their hearts and their souls and their minds to Caesar. For them to ask him about the finer points of the law was simply meaningless. They had already worshiped Caesar. They had no standing or authority to question him about anything. But Jesus presses on. Jesus says, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, this idolatrous coin that you should have no part of anyway, but give to God what is God's." What did the Jews say they owed to Yahweh? Psalm 96 is clear. "Ascribe," that is, "give to the Lord, O families of the peoples. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts." This is what a true Jew, this is what a true human being owes to God. Ourselves, our souls and bodies, as a living sacrifice to God, holy and acceptable, which is our spiritual service. "Give God what you owe him," he tells his enemies. What do they owe him? Obedience, love, honor, praise, worship, sacrifice. Jesus says to his enemies, "Whose image do you bear?" The coin bore the idolatrous symbol of Caesar. Jesus invites his enemies to answer seriously the question whose image they bear. They bear, as we all do, God's image. My friends, we at this end of our liturgical year are invited to take a rigorous self-assessment about the image that we bear. To whom do we owe our highest obligations? And I hope that you'll say or acknowledge that we owe our highest obligations to God alone. Who owns you? Does the president own you? Does the governor own you? Does the IRS own you? Does your boss or your job or your credit card bill, do they own you? Jesus, you see, in this passage claims to be Lord of all nations, not just simply in some place far, far away, but Jesus is saying here in this passage that he is the king, the long-expected king of Israel, and if king of Israel, then king of the world, king of the nations. And his law is the law not of some place far, far away, some place called heaven. His law is the law of this place here. His kingdom is not from the world, but his kingdom is certainly for this world. Do we obey him as the king of this world? Or do we think more about Jesus as more like life insurance for the next world? But if he is the king of this world, then he must have a law. And we heard his law read at the Feast of All Saints just this past Sunday. Blessed is the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Not the kingdom someplace called heaven, but the kingdom, which is heaven's kingdom, here. Theirs is that kingdom. My friends, we are image bearers of God. We are Jesus' brothers and sisters, and we bear his image as we go about our business day by day. This is no revolution. I'm not calling you to bear arms against the magistrates of our day. Jesus and all of his apostles were clear from the outset that we are not to make enemies of the rulers of our day, but to acknowledge the fact that all of their power comes from God alone. And it is not theirs, but they only hold it as subjects. And so we are not to serve them as our final authority, but knowing truly that their day finally will come when they too must take off their crowns and kneel before the true ruler, which is Jesus himself. We are to be true subjects of our King, giving ourselves daily to God in ourselves and our souls and bodies. You see, this gospel isn't primarily about taxes or about money, but about how we are God's representatives in this world, and our allegiances can never be divided. Our allegiance must finally be with Jesus himself. But you see, then, the way that we spend our money is one of the best evidences of what is important to us. That's why I began by talking about how it is that in this gospel hits us right where it hurts, right in the pocketbook. That is the place at which our hearts so often lie. We are in the middle of stewardship season right now, and stewardship season is a moment for us to think seriously about our money and to think seriously about where our money comes from. The vestry has asked you to make your pledge in the fall each year so that they can budget for the upcoming year and for the ministries and mission of this parish. And they've invited you to return those back to the altar next Sunday. But all of this relates back to this question: where does your treasure lie, and whose image do you bear? If every moment of your life is spent scrimping and saving and fearing for your future, then we know that your God is not the God of the heavens, but is the God of the mortgage, the God of credit card, God of all various and sundry other places. But the charity that the church invites each member of her assembly to show each moment is called to show that charity not only to those who are in need, but also in stewardship to the ministry of the church. We so often will invite you to put money into the offering plate. We've kind of fallen out of that habit as we've moved into our grammar school commons. But the offering plate invites you to show how it is that your life now is placed on the altar, even as the offering bag is placed on the altar, as a sign that we place ourselves and our souls and our bodies upon the altar. When I think about the offering plate, I think about the story of a little girl sweating through an overly long sermon, perhaps like this one, in a southern church like the one that I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, with no air conditioning in it. And the poor little girl leaned over to her mother as the preacher got to his fifth and final point and said, "If we give him the money now, will he stop preaching?" I hope that that isn't the case for my sermons or Father Heaton's sermons, but nonetheless, it's always awkward for us to talk about money. But I simply remind you of the fact that Jesus, even as he spoke to his enemies in our gospel lesson today, he speaks to us as friends about how it is that we are to be givers, not only of our time and our talents, but yes, even our money for the spread of the gospel. Whose image do you bear? It is Jesus's. Amen.